History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned over the years is that really, they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest a little time to patiently listen as memories that may have been buried for decades start coming to life again. The idea behind this show is simply to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The man we have the privilege of hearing from today is 97 years old, but he sure doesn't sound like it. He survived the Battle of the Bulge and one of the most challenging elements of it, the Siege of Bastogne, while serving with the 101st Airborne's 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. We're going to hear about that, but as usual, we want to go back to the beginning so we all get a feel for who these veterans were before the war and eventually after the war, because all of that puts the life-altering reality of World War II in perspective for us. Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico is our guest today.
You're born day after Christmas, 1924, growing up in Henrietta, Oklahoma. That's a time period, your childhood, where a lot of people had to leave Oklahoma because of the Dust Bowl. What do you remember about those Depression years?
You speak of the Dust Bowl. Now, if you look at a map of Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas and New Mexico, there's a bowl there, and that's where the Dust Bowl was. And then out on the peripheral was where the lesser. So my memories of the Dust Bowl are not of the Dust Bowl, because Henrietta is in the eastern part of Oklahoma, and we didn't have any dust like you see in the pictures. That's out in western Oklahoma, Texas Panhandle, up in the southwest part of Kansas, eastern Colorado, and eastern New Mexico. So if you look, that's just an area there in that quadrant of four states.
I imagine, even if you didn't see the Dust Bowl, the literal Dust Bowl, you dealt with the effects that the Great Depression had on families all over the country.
Oh, yes. But there again, it wasn't anything, because they're the neighbors and the kids I went to school with. We were all in the same situation, so it was nothing unusual to us, because that was the environment that we were raised in. And being 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense. I'm just wondering, for people today listening to this, if there's a kid who's an age now that you were then, if they might have their eyebrows raised a little bit by some of the reality. Can you give us a taste of what life was like there as a boy in Oklahoma compared to today?
Well, we had very little, and I was the youngest in the family. So eastern Oklahoma is hill country, and we roamed the hills, and we played. We gathered nuts in the fall and on. Now, one of the things that is on those hills that we did was somebody had taken a cable and tied it to a tree at the top of a hill and down to a tree at the bottom and put a pipe on it with wire holding a stick, and we'd climb the tree and they would throw that up to us. We'd grab a hold of the stick and swing out of the tree, and we slid down the cable to the bottom. Well, I see nowadays that here's all these cruise ships and Disneyland and every place else. They strap you into a seat and on, and they let you slide down a cable. Well, that was just play with us back then, and we didn't think anything different.
So you were ziplining before that term had been originated, and I'm just wondering, how about all those landings? Were all those landings perfect, or did you ever have an abrupt end to one of those ziplining adventures?
Oh, no, because as you got down, we didn't have anything.
And you mentioned you're the youngest in the family, so you had an older brother and an older sister?
Two brothers and one sister.
Y'all get along okay?
Oh, yes. As I say, they were older than I was. They were out doing their thing. So was my sister. So that was, it was a different childhood.
And it's been a few years. Did you play sports in school or anything?
When I got to high school, I went out to the football team, but I wasn't a football player. I was always back on the bench. But otherwise, our games were not organized. We played ball, baseball, while it was workup, and you went out into the field. Then you got the bat, why you had to swing. There was no standing there. You swung when the ball was thing. And if you struck out, well, you went the field, and the next man worked up. So everybody got to play. You cut a stick club in like a shrub, and with a carnation small milk can, well, you played, let's say, street hockey. But so you batted that up and down the street, and there again, you got on one side or the other, and we called it shinny. And if the ball was opposite team, got on the other side of the ball, why, it wrapped them on the shins and yelled, shinny. So everybody played. Nobody had baseball bets of this and that.
Well, and you talked about when you got to high school, and while you were in high school, in fact, just a few weeks before your 17th birthday, there was something happened that changed the world and certainly changed the lives of Americans everywhere. That attack on Pearl Harbor, do you remember how you found out what had happened way out there?
Oh, that was a Sunday. We were downtown where we kids hang out in the afternoon, and word come out, Pearl Harbor's been attacked. So that was the way we learned. But there again, we knew nothing of Pearl Harbor, and it was only through the newspapers. And I say the newspapers then were a lot different. And there was the local newspaper. Then there was other newspapers brought in. And I had a newspaper route there that I got a nickel a week for if I could collect it. And then from then on, well, of course, the whole United States then was on the same period of alert and preparation for war. Then Roosevelt brought in the four National Guard divisions for a year's training when they declared war. But the first draft was those that were 21 and older. And then when war started, Roosevelt lowered the age to 18. When you come 18, why, you registered for the draft, and the draft board, since we were seniors, and the last semester, why, they deferred us till we graduated, and then we were all drafted into the service.
So you turned 18 in December of 42, but they let you graduate in 43 before you had a report.
Yes, but I had to register for the draft to want to become 18 in 42.
And by that time, was your brother already in the service?
Oh, yes. He had been in the National Guard, the 45th. And my sister had formed the WAX and the WAVES and the WASP. And she enlisted, one of the first to enlist in the Coast Guard. So she served in the Coast Guard.
They called that the SPARS, I believe, right?
Yes.
And where did your brother end up?
He wound up in the Signal Corps in New Jersey. One thing about him was that as a lieutenant, well, he had developed stomach ulcers and became 4F. And they discharged him. But the thing was that he wasn't eligible for any medical facilities then, because they said ulcers, you had those before you became an officer, so therefore you're ineligible. But he said, I was an enlisted man before I was an officer, and when you commissioned me, you discharged me here and then immediately commissioned me. So I couldn't have got the ulcers in that 1 minute. So that presented a little bit of a dilemma to them. So they retired him. So he retired during the war as an officer and then on. So that was his experience.
And as for you, so you're drafted into the Army. Did you have any idea what to expect? Give me that journey from high school graduation to, hey, Dwayne, you're in the Army now.
All right. When I was drafted in, went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where I was inducted into service. And like many other people of the Depression, that was the first time I ever had two new pair of shoes at one time, an overcoat. I had all these new clothes. Then I was sent to Aberdeen, where I took my basic training. Basic training was over. I was sent to artificer training. And when that was over, I was sent to Fort Meade, Maryland, where they were modifying Enfield 1917 rifles, cutting the stocks off, cutting the barrel off, and shorting them. They never said where they were going, but making them shorter stock, shorter barrel, why, that meant they were to be used by a smaller size man. So we made up our mind then they were going to China through there to fit the Chinese or the Asians. We were a smaller stature. Then I went on maneuvers down in Georgia. Then I came back and I went to non-commissioned officer school. That's then where I went in after that, said, I don't want to change recruits. Send me overseas to fight. So I got put in the pipeline and then went to Camp Shenango and Camp Shanks and overseas to 10th Replacement Depot.
Did you have any idea how your parents felt about you volunteering for overseas service?
Oh, no.
And was that journey across the pond uneventful, or were there some memorable incidents on the way?
No, it was the usual convoy. Went over on the SS Argentina, which had been a passenger ship from New York to South America. The only thing there was we were shoved down in the hole with bunk beds, which just in between. We had to keep our life jacket and everything off. So while I was going across, very uncomfortable with all your clothes, all of your gear, and everything in that little space. I thought, I'm going to sleep. So I took clothes off and curled up because I said, if this ship is torpedoed, I'm never going to get out, so I might as well sleep in comfort. But one of the things from that was when I got to England, we was up in off of Glasgow, and the first thing was called Ailsa's Craig. So that was my first view of the outer world. Was Ailsa's Craig. So here, when the Olympics, I learned the curling teams, all the curling balls came from Ailsa's Craig.
And just out of curiosity, had you ever been on a ship before?
Oh, no. There again, you asked about depression. We didn't have a car until later on. And so never been away from home, which is many other kids. Henrietta, there was a couple of Italian families, a couple of Greek families. There was a couple of Polish families. So the ethnic there was Indian and Anglo-American. So when I got to the Army, well, here I met all these kids from New York, and there was the coal miners, and there was the kids from California, and oh, they'd seen this movie star. And so we was in this to all these new cultures. Let's say, military-wise, I was a replacement, and replacements were orphans. We went one place to another. You never was one unit very long. Some of them, 6 weeks, you'd be into another unit in 6 weeks and on. So I got to England just before D-Day, and was sent down to Tidworth Barracks, or the 10th Replacement Depot, where we were put in charge of the 50 caliber anti-aircraft machine gun for base defense. The only thing is, it was inoperable and no ammunition, but we manned it 24 hours a day for 3 or 4 months.
So 50 caliber machine gun, but no ammunition, yet you guys are manning it knowing there's nothing you can do if something comes your way.
Yes. So they just put one of us on, and that was it.
Did that trouble you at all, that reality?
Oh, no. Have you ever heard of Colonel Killian? Mm-hmm. Well, he was commander of the 10th Replacement Depot while we were there, which was a brutal brig. A couple of men died in the brig from mistreatment. So if you've never run across the history of the 10th Replacement Depot and Colonel Killian and his subsequent court-martial trial, well, you need to look it up.
Well, I'm guessing most of the people listening aren't familiar with that. You want to give us your nutshell version of what unfolded there?
If you came in late from a pass, why, he was taken to the brig, and he put you up for court-martial for desertion. After the war, he was nominated to be a general. And one of the men who had been in the brig saw it, and he went to his congressman, and the congressman went to the president, and Truman would not approve his promotion. At that time, when the injured come back to England and then they were reassigned, why, they came through the depot. It was just like somebody grocery shopping. The divisions in Normandy, why, they sent in their list for so many infantrymen or mortarmen, artillery, whatever units they missed, and they filled their order and sent them to Normandy. Well, the casualties in Normandy were infantry, which is in any combat. They ran short of infantry, and England was full of troops, signal, quartermaster, all the different support units. So they come through like 10th Replacement Depot, and they sent men down to Salisbury Plains, Tidworth Barracks, for infantry training, rifles, and sent them to France. And while we were there, why, that's when 501 officers came around wanting replacements. So I volunteered for the paratroops and went up to camp at Chilton Foliot, which was commanded by Captain Sobel of Ambrose and the Band of Brothers and on. So my jump certificate is signed by Captain Sobel. So I made my 5 jumps in one day and become a qualified paratrooper.
So I've got to ask you, only because so many veterans have told me over the years, the first rule of being in the military is never volunteer for anything. But you volunteer to jump out of an airplane when you've never jumped out of an airplane before. Why did you do that?
I've never been in one. Well, let's say this. I was in the cadre at Aberdeen Proving Ground. So I went into the orderly room one day and says, I don't want to train replacements, new recruits. You can send me overseas to fight. So, I don't know, the volunteer was just a thing.
So that wasn't the first time you volunteered for anything, because as you're clarifying now, because by the time you volunteer for paratroopers, you've already been in the Army over a year, and you're saying you could have stayed stateside and trained recruits at Aberdeen, and you said, no, I want to go overseas.
Yes, go overseas and fight.
Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, that was just the nature. That was just, I was in the Army, and that's what we would do. So I can't tell you why. That was just in my character.
It's time for our first break, but there is much more to come with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're going to hear about some of the close calls he experienced while serving with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in Europe, and what his experience was during the Siege of Bastogne. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.